Introducing The Vet Detective, brought to you by PSI Vet. A quick and candid series for veterinary professionals, where we uncover the underlying challenges that limit your business's potential. Featuring your host, PSI Vet's Kimberly Schaefer.
Hello and welcome, Vet Detective listeners. Today I have a very special guest from Not One More Vet. Dr. Erica Lynn Hendel graduated from the University of Pennsylvania's Veterinary Medical Scientist Training Program in 2016. They're joining us today with their role as a board member from Not One More Vet, a nonprofit organization transforming the status of mental wellness within the profession so veterinary professionals can survive and thrive. Dr. Lynn Hendel's advocacy efforts are centered in intersectionality and include BIPOC, LGBTQIA, and neurodiversity. So I'm very excited and honored to have you. Welcome. And I would like to just kind of let our listeners know who you are and how you got to where you're at.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. Kim, it's just so lovely to like meet you and get to share time with you over this hour. And also have the opportunity to have a conversation about some very important things near and dear to both of our hearts. So I am one of those people that always knew that I wanted to work with animals from a very young age. I didn't necessarily know what capacity. I was very interested in wildlife. I went to undergrad at UC Berkeley and got very interested in developmental biology. And so I actually ended up at University of Pennsylvania for graduate school for a PhD program in developmental biology. And I thought that my veterinary dreams were not going to be possible because I couldn't afford it. And I happened to meet someone who was like, hey, you know, there's a combined degree program here. Maybe you can apply. So I actually applied to the combined degree program at UPenn, which is the VMSTP, Veterinary Medical Scientist Training Program, and got in, which was pretty exciting. I honestly think that if during the interview process I had known how competitive it was, I probably would have not done as well as I did. I just kind of went in and was like, here we go. This is what I want to do. And I was really, really fortunate to be able to go to vet school through that program. When I graduated, I actually shifted to food animal medicine because I felt like it was a place where I could have impact on conservation through making sure that people can have a roof over the head, food in their bellies, and economic opportunities, so then they can be engaged in conserving the resources in their communities on an international scale. And I never quite got there, and there are kind of some other reasons why, but I was in the swine industry for about 4.5 years pursuing that. And I decided that there was a lot of work that I could do in advocacy work here in the United States, and that work would be done in a healthy way for me by moving back to small animal medicine. So I am now in Arizona. I do relief work. I have the opportunity to work with students on occasion, and I spend a significant amount my time with advocacy groups and affinity organizations within veterinary medicine. So I work with Not One More Vet as a board member and the chair of the student support and mentorship committee. And I'm the research and publications board member for the Multicultural Veterinary Medical Association. And I do stuff with, and I also do some work with Pride VMC. So a little bit across the board. It's mostly because I identify in a lot of different ways, and I end up working with a lot of different organizations to advocate and have a voice in those spaces.
I think that's great. You know, I started in medicine you know, 25 years ago, and it just wasn't even something that was included in my training. It wasn't included in, we just didn't have those resources, you know, and it's so good to see that there are resources that are coming out and making, being available, especially to students that are coming out of school. Yeah. You know, you had mentioned earlier that, you were worried about, you know, affordability of that school. Talk to me a little bit about that, you know, that hurdle, because I think that that is something that is, you know, I work with vets that are 10 years out that are still paying college tuition off, still paying loans, and that can be very stressful. So I was just wondering if you could talk to me about, you know, do you work with veterinarians that are struggling to be able to pay student loans and things like that, and how that affects them?
Yeah. Financial stress has an incredible impact on our mental health, right? And it has a huge impact on people's ability to feel like, to basically have freedom of choice, right? A lot of people will stay in toxic work spaces because of finances. Right? Because they have to pay their student loans. It's something that comes up very, very often in the non-V Facebook forum about people being like, I'm afraid to leave because I don't know where else I can go, right? If there's, if it's in an area where the non-compete radius is too big and where like people have families, right? All of these things are really, really difficult. And that for me, I definitely have privilege in not having as much debt associated with my education that provided me some space that when I was in a very, 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 very toxic situation that was not good for my mental health, that I had a little bit of time to heal, which can be very, very important. So this facet, I think, of financial insecurity and financial stressors, right? Which I think there are a lot of organizations talking about this and working to support veterinarians in financial planning and like debt reduction and kind of trying to provide guidance. But fundamentally, there still has to be a shift at some point, I think, about educational costs and our income to debt ratio. Right. Because I know, I mean, my parents are immigrants, and, you know, like beyond college, and, you know, I went to public school with very reasonable tuition, but like, I knew, yeah, I was like, I can't afford to go to vet school if I'm going to be focusing on like wildlife or like, And that was a so I do think that we lose a lot of people because I wasn't going to have the type of financial access to go to vet school. So I think that is something that a lot of conversations are happening. Dr. Christina Tron, who's the previous MCVMA president, wrote an amazing article about financial barriers to veterinary medicine. So that's a really great thing to search for and have a read. You know, I don't think I've heard any really good solutions. Like people are trying to give people support. NAMVI has support grants. And I believe there are other organizations that do their best to try and put together funds when there's a great need in particular areas. Like I know that Vin Foundation pulls together, will raise money to help support veterinarians who are also dealing with like natural disasters and things that compromise their ability to work. But yeah, when you think and like when these things come together and layer together, yeah, it's a big problem.
Well, and then on the flip side, on the technical staff too, you know, may not have the college debt, but don't make a living wage.
Right. Yeah.
In order to support themselves as a single person, they have to rely on a double income in order to, you know, pay the mortgage or pay rent.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have seen some some programs where practices are, or these programs are working with students to develop them into mentor, you know, having a mentor program so that they have the ability to learn how to be productive early out of school instead of just being thrown into a practice that's potentially toxic where it's like sink or swim, you know, when you don't have a specific mentor who's really helping guide you to be a productive doctor. So I hope that we start seeing more programs like that and people putting the time and investment in to mentor these new students.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or even students that are a couple years out, you know?
Right. That mentorship is very important. And I really appreciate that you brought up some of the, like the fact that people are taking action to focus on this. Because in academia, like during training, you know, we're mostly, a lot of programs are mostly focusing on the medicine, right? And of course, that's important. But there's a lot more to the art of practicing medicine, and really solid mentorship can make the biggest difference, not only with, you know, production, but also with confidence, in practice and also just and mental health.
Yeah. I came across one company that's called Grow a Better, and they have a mentorship program for new veterinarians. And one of the things that they incorporate in their training and mentorship program, and they have like, you know, they have their mentorship program where they like, you know, they're building the doctors to for medicine. But part of that includes like mandatory vacation at certain times. Mm. And they provide a stipend right off the bat for their mentee to go buy a new wardrobe. Because it's like, it seems kind of comical, but it's like, wow, can you imagine just struggling to get through school with, you know, with the bills that you have and, you know, vet students and just college students in general.
Right.
Generally poor, you know, and they come in and they get this new job, and it's like someone hands you something to go give yourself a refresh and give yourself a treat. I mean, that can do so much for personal confidence and kind of, you know, feeling good. And so I you know, that was something that I zoned in, like, yeah, all these other things are really great, but wow, like that's so great to hear in a veterinary practice. So I think, yeah. Tell me a little bit about what NAMVI is doing, Not One More Vet is doing, kind of on a broad spectrum, and since you're a board member, kind of like different pieces that they have, different areas of how they're working with practices, not just like suicide mm-hmm. prevention or, you know, mental health, but like what else is NAMVI doing that is really kind of impactful to these veterinary practices?
So right now we have a program that is being like beta tested and launched called Clear Blueprint. And it's a certification process that involves a lot of training modules and discussions on how do we create mentally healthy workspaces. So practices who are committed to that can go through this process, and it's definitely evolving. And it's, I think that it's really exciting, like in my opinion, because I think that any type of third party verification is really important, right? Like consistency of standards. Like we don't even have something consistent across the board for educational training experiences or access to like mental health resources at universities. And I'm talking about like broader, also like graduate school in general, not just veterinary school, or things like accommodations or accessibility for people with like chronic illness, neurodiverse individuals, like all of these things are a patchwork quilt, and it's not just our industry. So one of NAMVI's programs with the Clear Blueprint is seeking to like create a form of standardization that is evidence-based off of mental health research and mental health resources, and will continue to evolve and provide practices with the support that they need to really, you know, contribute to that process.
Very exciting.
Right. So, and this is something that, you know, has been executed at a much faster pace than, you know, the original board members and the founders, you know, working off of a shoestring budget could have, you know, were dreaming of. So now, you know, from being a Facebook support group started by Dr. Nicole MacArthur in 2014 to like a 501c3 nonprofit that has, you know, staff and full-time staff that is working with a bunch of tremendously talented and passionate volunteers from all over the world to develop new programs. And we have programs that have been like support grants that have been available for one of our like first main big programs. There's Lifeboat, which is a completely anonymous one-on-one or like high support to individual longer term support process for you know, peer-to-peer support that is where all of the volunteers have undergone extensive training. We have like mental health workers that are starting to join our volunteer team that you know, provide guidance and expertise. And we have more programming that is in the works. I mean, we have more projects that are coming forward all the time for strategic planning. But of course, you know, we've got to do one thing at a time, if that makes sense. So yeah. And another example, you know, NAMV does as an organization really seeks to partner with as many organizations as possible. So Not One More Vet and the Multicultural Veterinary Medical Association, MCVMA, work together to do a study on intersectionality or BIPOC, which is Black, Indigenous, and people of color veterinarians and mental health. And that is in the process of being published.
That's really cool. You mentioned that was something that you're focused on. Can you talk a little, you know, tell our listeners a little bit more about that in the sense of, you know, kind of your focus areas that you're passionate about?
Yeah. So I am Asian American, mixed race, and non-binary and neurodiverse. So in all of these different aspects kind of inform how I move through the world, how I interact with people. And I, you know, just as an example, like I didn't see someone who looks like me until I was 19, 20, because my mom is from Taiwan, my dad is from Germany, and you know, there weren't a whole lot of people like me where I grew up. And I think that lived experience and like racism definitely showed up in my life from a very young age. And at times even within the home. And that can be really, really difficult on its own. But I think also moving through like being in an industry that has a lot of opportunity. We have a lot of opportunity ahead of us to increase the diversity within our profession, so our profession can more represent like the people that we serve and the communities that we serve. Another thing that's really important to note is that like our support staff is more diverse than we are as, you know, within as like the veterinary cohort, right? So I think when we talk about mental health, because there's a lot of evidence, not in veterinary medicine specifically, but in a lot of different places about disparity between dominant culture and marginalized identity with mental health access, getting appropriate mental health care, getting appropriately diagnosed. For example, I am autistic and like BIPOC autistic individuals are very frequently, and also like women or femme humans are distinctly not diagnosed appropriately. So people don't get the resources that they need to thrive. And also sometimes, like for example, to find a therapist or mental health worker that has experience and knowledge or lived experience with racism or some of the things that our colleagues face on a daily basis, both within the clinic and outside of the clinic, can be really difficult. It can be a barrier in it of itself. So it's something that I'm very passionate about but there are a lot of resources, right? In general, there are, if we look at a lot of Black and Indigenous social justice advocates, when they talk about mental health, there's a lot of very powerful information there. Things like the radical aspect of rest, like a radical rest. Right. And actual rest, not like I have to sleep because I have no choice and my body will break down. How many times do we do that as veterinary staff and veterinary professionals? But like, I will actually rest and not feel guilty about it. And rest does not involve cleaning your house and folding your laundry and feeding yourself. Like that stuff is baseline maintenance, right?
Right. I have, I've had this conversation, you know, just in my career, just visiting lots of different practices, you know, and even in my own career, you know, I had a great boss. I don't have anything negative to say about the practice that I worked at. I'm where I am now because of that. But, you know, we didn't have like a designated lunch break. We didn't close until the last couple of years that I was there. Mm-hmm. We really didn't, you know, we didn't do that. And when I would hire people in, it was the culture when, you know, I'd get younger employees that I would come in and I want to train them and they'd be like, what time do you take your lunch break? And where do I go to eat? And I'm like, what? Right. Like, we don't do that. And like, you're ingrained to feel instantaneously to judge that person that they need that, you know, like, I don't get a break. I have to work this whole time. But then I think about it later and I'm like, well, I want a break. Why would
we all need it
for this?
Oh, and, we all need it. We don't think that we need it.
Right.
And this is how people end up in burnout, right? Is because burnout isn't something that happens overnight.
No.
Right.
Over years and years of the same thing.
Right. And so like when we don't stop and take care of our bodies and give us ourselves time to like breathe and process. And like in general, also just like be in touch with ourselves and how we're feeling, not just based off of we have there's tremendous amount of strain in our profession. It's hard, right? Like all medical professions are hard.
Yeah.
Because we are empathetic human beings that care very deeply.
Yeah.
And we are acting in service of our patients and our clients and in each other, hopefully, right? That's what I really push for
as
well, right? Well,
and I will say that, you know, I don't want to harp on my practice, because we did eventually, you know, we always looked out for each other. We always made sure that we were taken care of. We had people, you know, that were telling us to drink water. And I was like, I don't have time to drink water. I don't have time to drink water. But we did end up closing for an hour, and we evolved. But now on the other side, I'm advocating for these other practices. Like, if you don't do this, you will lose your team. If you don't value their time, they're letting them have a minute. Like, I worked with a doctor who, she's like, I don't care what anyone says, I'm going to go sit in my car for 15 minutes and take a mental break. And that's what I need. And statistically, it actually, if you take, you know, a 10 or 15 minute break, like walk around outside or just take a break from what you're doing, your productivity is so much better when you come back. Your focus is much better. But we don't give ourselves that 10 minutes because we're like, I just think of all the things I could do in 10 minutes that I'm going to be wasting if I take this break. But then think of how much more productive you would be and how much more focused you would be if you did. And so, you know, I just think it's crazy if you don't allow for that.
Right. I will also point out, because this follows us home too, right? Follows us home. And I'm going to make a statement that productivity doesn't have to be the measure of our success.
Yeah.
Right. So especially when we're talking about mental wellness, right? So taking that 15 minutes break, that I would like to frame the productivity, right? Let's say taking that 15 minutes, we can increase our focus. We can enhance our engagement with the task at hand. We can open our creativity. We can improve our, we can reduce mental fogginess, which can improve our ability to pick up on things or improve our decision-making process. And this is part, like, I do this all the time in all of the rooms that I go to. So this really emphasizing this point that although 100% when we are talking about veterinary medicine as a profession with business involved, like, yes, productivity is very important. But when we pair that with mental wellness and say, we take these things so we can pull more productivity out of our team, that in my opinion continues the cycle that we're talking about, like kind of like the short-term gains, like of I can be more productive today. When if we look at a person holistically over many years, right, what do we want our profession to look like? Right. Yeah. What direction do we want to go? And this can also be like on a personal level, on a like a direct community level, on a practice level, and an industry-wide level, right? This is why I love working with students, because my objective is with as many students as I can work with to like inspire their confidence in themselves, their ability to like listen and be stewards of their own mental health and to advocate for the well-being of their communities, and just like support the process of people being fully connected with themselves and not just as veterinary professionals, right? Because we interact with people in a multitude of ways. I have not really seen as any other profession outside of medicine, right? That like, we're almost like veterinary professionals no matter where we go. Mm-hmm. Right. And that sometimes is part of the problem, right? We are veterinary professionals, and we are also so many more things on top of that. And the more in touch we are with that overall, like the more that when we can go into work as whole people, I think that we can practice medicine as whole people.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important.
I have a controversial question for you. just because it's something that I hear and I see and I think is not always malicious. Actually, most of the time it's not malicious, not meant to be, not ill-willed, but it is unintentionally, is when you hear the different generations of people saying, these new doctors coming out, they just want to make a lot of money and work 30 hours and not work as hard. And it's really hard to have that in my practice. Or these people, like, they just, you know, want all this, but don't want to work hard for it. And I know that that's not the case. And I spend time talking with them, like, actually, it's your approach and you actually can get a lot, you know, you can actually have a much better relationship and have a good employee, a good, strong employee, if you change your thought process. But what do you say to those kind of older thought process? Like, you come out of school, you work 70 hours a week and you're just fine with it. And anyone who can't handle that, essentially that old culture of being weak or entitled. Sorry, I should have given you
I very much value like this, that question. And it's very important. It's a very important conversation to have. I think this type of, like, often there is, we're in a different world, right? The world does not stay the same. And the way or the value of, you know, the spending capacity of a dollar, right, has really changed a lot. How the affordability of veterinary education has changed a lot. The amount of medicine that we are expected to be able to perform on a dime is profound compared to, you know, 50 years ago, right? It's magical, but it's also, you know, so this concept of working hard, right? Like, you have to work 70, like, I would like to sit down, anyone who had that type of, I just want to sit down and be like, interesting, tell me more about why you feel that 70 hours a week is appropriate.
Yeah.
What was your home life like?
Right?
Like, I want to ask those people,
they don't have one,
you know? If they had a home life, what kinds of things, like, if they feel like everyone should live their lives like they did, you know, like, I have all sorts of questions. And I think usually in that space where there's controversy, which, you know, being the type of person that I am, right, there's a lot of controversy in the world in discussing marginalized identity, LGBTQIA like existence, like,
yeah.
And often with those people who are choosing to approach something by diminishing others, or I think that often it comes from, like, it's hard to feel like part of your experience is maybe not being honored in the same way by following generations, or, like, because what does that mean, right? What does that mean that someone has sacrificed and that's not considered acceptable anymore? And that can be really hard. So I think that running a practice is really hard, but there's a lot of examples where companies that put people first and, like, create more space for that actually can be very, very wildly successful. Oh, because
absolutely
enthusiastic absolutely. Staff that feel like whole and happy and engaged and rested, interact, create an experience, right? Create an experience for people who come through the door into a practice because they have an experience of culture, right?
Yeah.
So if you have happy, enthusiastic, caring, and engaged people running a clinic who can really connect with the clients and patients that are coming through.
Right. I mean, that's the human animal vibe that we all do. Right? Right? Like, that's what you want to see. I mean, beautiful answer. That's exactly what I was hoping that you would say. I just had to ask it.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that, you know, it's something that we resonate with each other on. That's great.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, you have, I think in general in the veterinary industry, change is probably the hardest thing for veterinary professionals. And I'm not foolish to think that that's not the same in any other industry, but, you know, sometimes I feel like the veterinary industry is just light years behind the rest of the world in, you know, what we do, how we interact with clients, how we, you know, we make assumptions for their ability to pay for their pets. We make, you know, we kind of want to be this all person. And yet we will also say that, oh, well, we're more like a family in our practice and we treat each other like a family. But sometimes in those family practices, they really aren't treated like family. You know, sometimes the employees are running up bills for the practice, you know, and so they're taking advantage of the owners, or the owners are taking advantage of their time and not respecting that they need a work-life balance. And so it always, whenever I hear someone like say, oh, we're really a close-knit family here, you want to have that close-knit ability. You want to have happy, engaged employees, but you also have to, it gets too complicated when you try and get that way, because then your personal beliefs are going to be put down onto your team, which is inappropriate in a lot of times.
Right. I mean, I think there could be a whole entire philosophical discussion about like the nature of work and workspaces and like values and how we, and like culture. So like often when people say, okay, you know, this is like a family, right? That I find that very interesting to me, because like not everyone has super positive family experiences, right? So, and that's why I think, you know, asking specific questions about culture and communication culture, I think that is always very important for people entering into collaborative work agreements to really be able to understand each other's values and also how people want to work, right? Yeah. So for me, as a person who is queer, sometimes like having conversations about my personal life is like really uncomfortable. Because there is not necessarily like, or, you know, being autistic and the different ways that I communicate, or when I'm tired and I'm like, I don't feel like masking anymore. So masking is the process of doing things to fit in with what is referred to as neurotypical culture or dominant culture, which is relatively arbitrary. So things about like how I might move, like hand motions or sounds I might make, or whether or not I'm going to make eye contact, or what is happening like sensorially, like all of these things can be very like personal, and it can be very difficult to, so like masking is the process of like where I focus on like doing things that make other people more comfortable around me. And so sometimes like people who have things about themselves that are different, talking about personal things in the workplace can be like very uncomfortable, because like I don't know what kind of response I'm going to get.
Yeah.
Right. So that's also for a lot of like non-binary and trans and gender non-conforming individuals, especially given like the political climate that exists in the country today, it can feel very challenging to
and
be
isolating
and isolating, incredibly isolating. So, and then of course, right now, there are a lot of things that are happening around legislation that, you know, like different cohorts of people are having a really difficult, like these things add into our mental health journey, right? So when we're talking about, oh, you know, like we're all family here, but what does that mean, mm-hmm. right? How does that, how are we supporting each other? And I do think that there are more like practices that are keying into like saying the values, like really getting specific and defining them as like more important. So I'll see practices that are now focusing on like compassionate care. That's like a very, that's a more specific thing.
Yeah. In my opinion. We've talked about doing like when you've, you know, a lot of times people will do reviews or they'll do, sometimes they'll do, you know, satisfaction surveys and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talk about doing things more like a state interview. Like you interview people when they leave, you interview people when they come in, but you don't really necessarily interview your team. And instead of asking questions like, you know, what would you change about this practice or what do you hate about this practice? But like, do you feel emotionally safe? And, you know, I don't think that people always think to ask that question. And someone who is, you know, quote, different or outside of the societal norms, they may answer no, and no one understands. Like, well, what do you mean? Like, we think everyone's family here, but right. Being able to have something like that where you are in tune to knowing whether or not you're providing an emotionally safe space for people to work in, I think is important. And I've recently been seeing people ask about different types of inclusion and diversity training and practices. And I was wondering if that's something that you are familiar with or know how to get resources on that in practices.
So there are some resources that have become available historically. So like, Purdue has a certificate program. AVMA has a Brave Space program. And now this is where I say like, these are my opinions. I think that this is a great step, right? VMI also has the Journey Guide from the Veterinary Medical Executive Association. So all of these organizations are pulling together and being like, we're putting this together. This is our diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging program, right? Mm-hmm. I really appreciate and value the efforts that are being taken. I feel very skeptical about a lot of them because what it does is it creates this like checkbox.
Yeah. I've heard that.
And also it's very limited. Like a lot of these are very much designed to like introduce these concepts to dominant culture groups without maybe getting into more detail. And like really authentic personal conversations, because often people, it's this concept, sorry, I'm going to jump around a little bit. There is this book, the author's names are escaping me at the moment, but this book called Radical Dharma. And one of the authors puts forward this concept of moving at the speed of trust. Right. And a lot of people who have experienced oppression or racism or marginalized identities that have like had access to things like restricted, have barriers put in front of them, like have when they use their voice, receive punishment or like consequences, like professional consequences. Entering into this situation where people are like, we are doing all this work. We want acknowledgement that our DEI programming is great, right? And a lot of these are, in my opinion, designed with corporate language for a very, very personal thing.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes it falls flat, right? So MCVMA has a conference RISE coming up in November, can be found on their website. It's entirely BIPOC veterinarians and staff and professionals presenting over, I think it's a weekend conference. I had the opportunities to speak last year and I'm probably going to speak again, but we have people with BVEDS, who's British organization, talking about diversity, equity, inclusion. We have an organization in Canada that's also going to be having speakers come. That is an excellent resource for people to join because this is, it's very much committed to amplifying voice, like from communities speaking about the things that are important to them and the things that they're impacted by. And getting that authentic voice is something that's really important. And that's something that I, you know, I think that a lot of DEI programming is really great, but one should always ask the question is, who designed this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like who benefits, right? Like who designed this? Like what is the expected output? And usually if like anyone is like, this is the answer, after you have this training, everything is going to be sparkles and rainbows. Like it's not.
Yeah.
It's not going to be. And now it's not saying that it can't be that in a practice, like in a very, in that a community can't achieve incredible things. The thing is that the greater world that we live in is going to be hard. Like I and a lot of colleagues, right, hold that when we move through the world beyond when we walk through the doors at clinics or our places of work, we have an entire world that we are navigating from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed. Also sometimes in our dreams, you know, like that can be a really hard thing. Right. And so, it's very difficult to put that into a 1-hour webinar and stop. Like it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So we do the best that we can. And I would say the resources that I mentioned are really great. I would say cultural humility is a really important phrase. So this is not versus cultural competency. So cultural humility is this commitment that it's like a lifelong learning process. Because all of this thing is going to evolve. Racism has changed, right, in our country and the way that it has expressed.
Yeah.
I have a very good friend of mine who is an incredible civil rights activist out of Iowa. Their name is Buffy Jameson. And they joined me for a talk on neurodiversity for veterinary students and pointed out, like, you know, there's a point in time where Irish and Italian individuals experience a lot of racism and in some areas, like there's still reminders of that, but that has changed, right? And so it's the phrase of like, how white are you? Like, what is white?
Yeah.
Right. And what is whiteness? That has changed over time. The experience of racism has changed over time. The way that discrimination against LGBTQIA individuals, so that's and the IA, because most people say LGBTQ+, the IA is intersex and asexual. So you know, there's a lot of communities that have always existed that are still like fighting for equal rights and human rights.
Yeah.
Like, for example, marriage equity, like there's still for disability. There are individuals that can't get married, otherwise they'll lose they won't be able to be on disability anymore if they exceed a certain amount of income because they get married and will then be filing jointly.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
This is so helpful, all of this information. You know, I'm always learning too. And I just think that it's wonderful that there are people that are out there to be advocates and to be allies for people who, you know, are struggling. I think that the ability for Not One More Vet to, and the other programs that you're working with to be able to create, awareness and come together and have platforms for people to really kind of come together, I think is incredible. I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, discuss the heavy topic of suicide in the veterinary industry and how, you know, I think even at this point, it's like suicide and Not One More Vet are like paired together. You know, like we think of Not One More Vet as the resource for this problem, but it's not. I mean, it's so multifaceted. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the things that we see and you know, it's not just like, oh, I see sad animals and, you know, I'm depressed, or, oh, I had mental health issues before I went to vet school. Talk to me a little bit about why it's so much higher and stronger in the veterinary industry than a lot of other industries.
So, I mean, there are unfortunately like enough industries that are struggling with high suicide rates that I'm going to reframe a little bit and say that being higher than the average population by a lot, right? Like, so I think the most recent estimate was 2.5 to 3 times higher rate compared to the average population. And that it changes based off of gender and probably a bunch of other things that we don't necessarily understand. So we've already talked about like financial stresses, right? That financial stressor, feeling trapped, that can come with it, where people are at times also isolated or feeling isolated because they don't feel like they can leave a situation that is harmful for them. We have...
or don't belong.
Yeah, or don't belong. We have... you know, recent things that have happened with cyberbullying and media, like painting, you know, particular practices and decisions that are like not really reflecting the actual situation, where like people are targeting like veterinarians for other things. So this strain, like a lot of, although I think there's research still to be pending as far as the strain that people feel overall in COVID and the mental health challenges and stressors that have been existing across the board and how it comes out sideways in situations for veterinary staff, right? Like that veterinary staff are getting the brunt of frustrations that don't belong to them, right? Yeah. From certain clients that, you know, are unable to like properly emotionally regulate around certain things. And that's hard because there are a lot of veterinary staff and veterinary places that are struggling with safety.
Yeah.
Right. And that is like having fear for the safety of your staff, and your colleagues, is really, it is tremendous, like, and a tremendous strain. And I think every loss that we have in our industry, there are so many, the ripple effects are always profound, because we are a very connected profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the unified support that we find in each other with organizations and peer-to-peer support groups like Not One More Vet, there are also additional support spaces and organizations that are focusing on mental health across the industry. And the way that I look at it is, and the way a lot of people and non-V and leadership and the staff and thing, the more people working on mental health, the better. And the only thing that we can do to like combat suicide, like loss of and death and loss of our colleagues to suicide, is prevention for a lot. Like the first step, like one step is prevention. Two is like the support, right? And just continuing to put the message out there that if you're having a hard time, that you are not alone, and that there are people who deeply care. And there are people who deeply care that, you know, you might not know exist.
Yeah.
But, and that there are places where people can reach out for support. Not One More Vet has the Facebook forum has a anonymous posting option, and where people can get support, peer-to-peer support, anonymously. And I think that's really important. That's very powerful, because, you know, sometimes people are in situations where that anonymity is important for safety, is important for job security, any number of things.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I think is I guess, tell me what your thoughts are, is, you know, those of us who aren't in that place, aren't in that mental space, and wondering what we can do, because it seems like such a shock every time, like, wow, I didn't know that person was fill in the blank, or I knew they had, you know, I knew they were struggling, but I didn't know it was that bad. For me, I think I was actually, I went through, ABMA did it a couple years, last year, the year before, they did their QPR training, and it was, something that I didn't understand, because it's like, you don't want to upset anybody any further, and you don't know whether you should openly talk about things, but mm-hmm. those are things that I learned, is that you do, like, QPR means question, persuade, and refer, and, you know, now I know that it would be more appropriate for me to just come out and ask, or come out and say, you know, and notice these different warning signs, but had I not been trained that, I would have never known that. And so, you know, what are other things that we can do as advocates, just in an everyday, you know, situation, where we can be aware of some of these triggers and things?
Yeah. I think that, well, you mentioned an excellent first step for people, to explore QPR certification. There are also additional other resources, like, just like we approach studying medicine, like, we can explore what mental health professionals and like national suicide prevention organizations recommend. And just like learning that process, that you can question, that you are not going to put that idea in someone's head or put them more at risk by asking, whether or not suicide is on their mind or if they have a plan. Like, you are not going to expedite the process that by having a conversation and getting someone and persuading someone to seek help, that you can help somebody move through that space and get onto a journey of healing. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why I say this as far as like a journey, is that suicidal ideation looks like a lot, can look like a lot of different things. And, you know, there's passive suicidal ideation, there's that, you know, is also very harmful. And so I like to expand that component of like, okay, well, not one more, but of course, like our objective is to not be necessary anymore. Right.
Yeah.
But I think also our mission is going to continue. We're not about like, we're pushing to thriving, right, with mental well-being. And so I think that talking about it, learning about it, and not just like really like learning more, getting involved, we can learn about what kind of resources and what actions and what steps to take. And also what it means to just like sit and hold space with someone.
Yeah.
I
like how you put that, because I think that, you know, we do a lot of personality testings when we go in with practices, and there's so many different personality styles, and mine is not one to sit and listen typically. You know, I'm a talker, and so I have to learn that like sometimes people don't want to know what I have to say. You know, like they just want to be able to tell me. Like I'm learning this. I've gone through a mental health journey with my daughter, and just like I don't understand how someone can hold so much in, because I don't think that way. But it's because I don't understand what they're going through. So I just make an assumption that they want to communicate like how I would communicate. And that sometimes can be very detrimental and actually be counterintuitive.
That's super powerful. And that really emphasizes like how powerful it is to, it's a skill, right? It's a skill to learn. I also work on this every day, right? To notice the things that I project on other people, right? Or it's also the thing of learning how to invite conversation. I think that's also a really important thing as far as learning how to create a space where people feel cared for and comfortable enough to be open about the things that they're having a hard time with, and then to have that dialogue. I think that there's going to be continued evolution of resources in this space. But I think that there's a lot to be learned from, like, example, like people who talk about facilitation, like nonviolent communication is a really great resource. And also this concept of understanding or deconstructing where judgment comes from, because stigma really, really, really prevents a lot of people from sharing about their struggles, from seeking mental health professional support, from therapeutic treatments and medications that can be really like life-saving for a lot of people. There are a lot of barriers that get put in the way because there's stigma. And it's not just the stigma like culturally or like as a profession. I mean, there are significant issues when it comes to how we navigate mental health and like licensing. Like there are people who have experienced compromise in their ability to practice medicine or have a job because of mental health disclosures. And that is something that's going to have to change in our industry rapidly, I think, because we are an industry that is suffering.
Yeah.
And
it's unfortunate.
And in order to alleviate that, we have to accept that.
Yeah. Right?
And
right, exactly. And thinking it's not a problem is never going to get you anywhere.
No, and you know, you can't heal something by ignoring it or dismissing it.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, earlier before we started recording, one of the things that you said that is just so true is that we don't know what we don't know, right? So, you know, there's things like I'm always trying to learn. I'm always trying to, you know, evolve, but there are so many things that I don't know. And every time I have a guest on this podcast, I learn even more. So, you know, I think we have to continue to just like learn more, whether you agree or don't agree or feel like it's right or it's wrong. It doesn't really matter, because at the end of the day, like when I think about all these different things that are less hidden anymore, right? Like, these, you know, different sexualities and different, races and things like that were not necessarily, race isn't necessarily hidden, but, you know, weren't really talked about. It's just, it is what it is kind of thing. Or you just keep your life at home and just be normal. Just be normal, right?
Well, what is that, right?
Exactly. But it's like, normal is relative to the person who says normal. And I think that it doesn't matter whether you agree with someone or don't agree with someone. Can they do the job at hand? And if they can, you support them, right? Or you train them, or you mentor them. Like we're all humans. We all need affection. We all need rest. We all need these basic human basic things to live and thrive. And I just think, I just commend you so much for the role that you have, that you're doing with not just not One More Vet, but the other organizations that you're in. And I'm so thankful to have you on as a guest. And like I said, I've learned more. I hope our listeners have learned more and just know that they have an advocate and an ally in their corner for mental health.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This has been a tremendously engaging and delightful conversation, even though like with hard topics, right? Yeah. And I think that's really important that like we can talk about difficult things and have a meet, like, and leave the conversation better for it. And I think that that's the important thing. I think that for practices that are like, how do we do this? How do we navigate these conversations? What I would offer for consideration is, you know, just be honest and transparent and to say, and allow things to be a like living, breathing process, because we are living, breathing people, to say, what do we need to talk about? How are we feeling? And to not assume that things can be done or dealt with in a checklist way, but that it has to be a continual process of check-in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great advice. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing all the wonderful things you guys are doing. You are just, you yourself and your Not More More Vet are just amazing. So thank you so much. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed all of this conversation, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of The Vet Detective. Like what you heard? Be sure to subscribe and tune in next time as we unfold our next veterinary mystery.